Currently, it's Paul Jones here, and I think we've only got a couple that have actually signed on so far. There's another one signing on. Somebody just join us?
Yeah, Rick Peterson.
Rick Peterson, oh, good. And the rest of those on the call, want to go ahead and introduce themselves?
Patty Wallenberg from NAMI, West Central Indiana.
Andy Carter from Agribility in Georgia.
I think that's all that I've signed on so far, but I imagine we'll have some others joining us here and soon. But we might want to go ahead and start and go from there.
Okay. Well, thank you, Paul, for the invitation to share some thoughts on the topic that I send the slides on. I just want to know if those on the call received the slides. So I will kind of follow the slides. If not, it is not a problem.
I said, Andy said you got it, and Rick, did you get the PowerPoint?
Yes, I did.
Okay, great. Okay.
And Sergio, welcome.
Oh, thank you. The topic that I would like to discuss with you is migration and mental health. And this is work that I have been involved with for over two decades now, and have a programmatic research program on this topic. And just to put in context about transnational migration, one of the slides that I sent, makes a comparison of the immigrants who were admitted to the U.S. The countries from which they originated. And this is a comparison between 1990 and 2000. And the country that is on top of the list is Mexico. And from 1990 to 2000, the immigrants coming from Mexico doubled. And the second country where people came from, is China. And it is significantly less numbers than the immigrants from Mexico. The other point that I wanted to make is that if you take a look at the foreign-born population in the U.S., and I have a table that goes from 1850 all the way to 2004, and there are different regions of birth represented on the table, from Europe and Asia to Latin America, etc. The point that I'm making there is in 2004 and 1990, the highest share of foreign-born here in the U.S. Came from Latin America. This gives you an idea about the migration dynamics that happens all over the world, but primarily here in the U.S. So putting all this together, some of the lessons I saw from Marcelo Suarez Orozco, and I totally agree with that, is that if we are to look at the worldwide immigration dynamics, we need to look at the U.S. experience. And Latinos are at the center of that experience. Likewise, if we are to examine the Latino population of the U.S., we need to look at the immigration because it's right at the center. Just to give you a sense, in 2005, about 40% of all Latinos were foreign-born, and the greatest majority came from Mexico. Here in California, I'm based in Sacramento, California, it is just remarkable the percentage of immigrants in some communities, and the number of households in which Spanish is the first language is also significant, about 45%. The other thing is that any systematic attempt to examine the U.S. Also has to focus on Latinos, and any systematic attempt to focus on Latin America also has to focus on U.S. Latinos. We recently wrote a chapter on mental health disparities among Latinos, and we pointed out what William Frey, a demographer from the Brookings Institute, he had a piece in The Economist back in January of 2010, and he calls this dynamic the Latinization of the U.S. And he, according to William Frey, this Latinization is one of the most important recent demographic changes in the U.S. Just to have a give you an idea, the most recent estimates of the Census Bureau forecast that the Latino population will double from today's roughly about 16% or 17% almost to about 30% by 2050. And Latinos have accounted for about 62% of the natural population increase in the U.S. Total population growth since 2000. And just to give you an idea about the proportion, as of July 2008, the U.S. Latino population ranks second worldwide. Number one is Mexico, that has about 110 plus million people, and the U.S. now has about 47 million. There is a joke, you know, among some people that says, you know, what is the second largest city of Mexico? And people say, you know, that some people say that is Los Angeles. Even though that is not true, because Mexico City has the greater metropolitan area, over 20 million people, and Guadalajara has about 6 million people. But just gives you a sense of, you know, the magnitude of this representation. One of the things that is important to also point out is that when we talk about Latinos, even though some people use it as a rubric, a monolithic rubric, in reality, there are significant differences between Latino subgroups. And these differences are manifested when it comes down to mental health, which is the focus of this talk, on prevalence rates and service utilization, as I will discuss briefly with you. Just to share with you a little bit more about Latino immigration, if you take a look at the data, there has been immigration, sustained immigration throughout the 20th century and what we have lived on the 21st century. There is a major impact of Latino immigration on the economy, not only the demography, but the economy of the U.S., with a significant you know, purchase power. And within Latino immigration, once again, Mexican, there is a Mexican prominence in the U.S. Foreign-born population. Just to give you a sense, about 25% of the total U.S. Latino population of close to 50 million are of Mexican origin. 30% of the total foreign-born U.S. population are of Mexican origin, and about 10% of the Mexican-born population on both sides of the Mexico-U.S. border are of Mexican origin as well. There is a lot of other pieces of information on trends of Latino population that I want to briefly mention to you. One is that about 75% of the U.S. Latino population are immigrants or children of immigrants. So immigration, once again, is at the heart of happening to Latinos. About 78% speak Spanish at home, and the U.S. Latino gross domestic product is larger than the gross domestic product of Spain and Mexico together. We surpassed $1 trillion, you know, in purchasing power, as I mentioned. One thing that I want to mention also is that starting in 2010, most of the Latino population growth results from birth, not immigration. And actually, there are some newer data that indicates that the immigration from Mexico and other Latin American countries has decreased in the last 2-3 years. One of the if we look at the crystal ball, you know, as to what's going to happen, what are the population estimates, what I can tell you is that the growth from 2010 2050 is going to be primarily on based on the second generation and the third generation, and by first generation the standard definition is that folks like me, I was born in Mexico and I have been living in the U.S. for about 23 years, and and my youngest son was born here in the U.S., so he would be second generation. And my grandson, I have one, only one grandson, he would be third generation. one of the specific populations that I wanted to bring to your attention is the migrant and seasonal farm worker populations. This is one of the groups that we have been studying, especially those of Mexican origin. Just to give you an idea, there are about 3 million workers who make their living through seasonal farm worker, farm labor, and they, you know, are itinerant, traveling the nation to support an agricultural industry and themselves, their families. About 96% of the migrant seasonal farm workers are foreign-born. 70% permanently reside in the U.S., and it is likely that that has increased in the last few years because the borders are not as permeable as they used to be. And they travel frequently between states for their employment. They face significant language barriers because only the minority say that they read and speak in English, you know, only 1 in 10. And they are predominantly male, over half are married, and over 4 in 10 have children. One of the pieces of information that is important to keep in mind is when it comes down to seasonal farm worker populations, that their median annual income is very, very low. An estimate that I included in one of the slides is that the median annual income of migrant and seasonal farm workers is about $8,200 a year, compared to about 42,000 of the U.S. workers. And the other issue is health insurance. For adults, about 85% of the migrant and seasonal farm workers are uninsured, compared to the low-income adults nationally. Those below the 200% federal poverty line, which are about 37% uninsured. So this is a very poor group that is constantly struggling for resources. And I'm bringing that up because poverty has been one of the key key factors when we think about what the World Health Organization called the vicious cycle of poverty and mental disorders. I included a depiction of how poverty is related to higher prevalence and lack of care and more severe course of mental and behavioral disorders, and how that in turn has an impact it has an economic impact in loss of job, you know, reduced productivity, etc. And this is kind of a spiral that really gets on the way, especially for immigrants, given that their primary reason for migration is to better themselves and their families. And, you know, if their poverty, their income, you know, high unemployment or low education relates to severe mental illness like depression, then it really shatters the dreams of folks. Why to concentrate on mental disorders? Let me take just a few minutes to tell you, try to summarize about three decades of research on the relevance of mental disorders. We know that mental disorders are among the most prevalent classes of chronic diseases in the general population. 75% of the most severe mental illnesses are manifested by age 24, and about 50% of the most severe cases are manifested by age 15. Ron Kessler, my colleague from Harvard, who has been doing the national comorbidity surveys here in the U.S. and providing, you know, the epidemiologic data on prevalence rates and service utilization, he calls the mental disorders the chronic conditions of the youth because, once again, they show up early in life. The other characteristic of mental disorders is that they coexist within themselves, with substance use disorders, and with many medical conditions. So someone who suffers from major depression might be having a drinking problem as well. And, you know, those who suffer from diabetes or hypertension or asthma or you name it, cancer, have a very good chances of having depression or other mental illnesses as well. The other very important piece is that only a minority with mental health needs receive treatment in the preceding year. And these are for folks that are in need of services because of the severe mental health problems that they suffer from. And the final thing as to why we ought to be paying attention to mental disorders is that mental disorders are among the most disabling of all chronic diseases. I don't know if you have heard about the landmark study that was commissioned to Harvard School of Public Health back in 1996 called the Global Burden of Disease. What this study did was to put on the map of public health the importance of mental illness in terms of the tremendous disability that it causes. And one of the things that this landmark study did was to document that if you consider among the top, that you consider the top 10 main causes of disability, five are mental disorders. And the number one continues to be, by the most part, major depression. And but there are others like schizophrenia, bipolar disorders, alcohol use, and obsessive compulsive disorders. And I'm a part of this very large World Health Organization initiative. I coordinate Latin America and the Caribbean of the World Mental Health Service Consortium, and we have nearly 40 countries participating. And it is remarkable that as we continue to collect this data from national surveys in various countries, consistently, mental illnesses tend to be among the top causes of disability. You know, let me at this point share with you some of the basic findings related to mental health and migration that you know, we have been following up and reporting for almost two decades now. And what I'll discuss with you very briefly is some of the findings of the Mexican-American Prevalence and Services Survey. This is a project that was founded by NIMH back in 1996. And the study was founded earlier, but we collected the data back in 1996 and part of 97. And I was the on-site principal investigator, and my friend and colleague Bill Vega was the PI. What I want to highlight to you is that one of the most striking findings in this study, something that we were not totally expecting, is that the strongest predictive power of the demographic variables that we were looking at, comparing the lifetime prevalence rates or 12-month prevalence rates of mental disorders, turned out to be where people were born. You know, and this was this study was done in Fresno County, in the heart of the Central Valley here in California. And as you may well know, Fresno County is primarily agricultural. And we did it with over 4,000 persons of Mexican origin. And we had we stratified the sample by gender and also by place of residence. So we had a kind of an equal number, about 1,000 urban residents, about 1,000 suburban or in towns and villages across the county, and about 1,000 totally rural. And also we included 1,000 seasonally employed migrant workers. And I included a series of graphs on the slides that I sent. And the point that I want to make with those graphs is that if you consider the lifetime prevalence of any disorders in our study that we call MAPS, and compare it with a sister study that was done in Mexico City using the same instrument and roughly the same methodology, and you compare it with the national norms here in the U.S., which at that time was the National Comorbidity Survey that Ron Kessler conducted, and they used the same instrument and also a similar sampling design, the differences are very interesting. Ron Kessler, the national norms showed that about 50% of the U.S. population will suffer in their lifetime from one or more mental disorders. The rates are a little bit higher for Hispanics, the Hispanics that were included in Kessler's study. And I want to make clear that those who were included in Kessler's study were English-speaking only, which tended to be those who were born in the U.S. So the other piece of information is that our MAP study, one out of three had or will have a lifetime mental illness, and this is compared with Mexico City, that was one in four. But the story really was when we broke down, you know, our sample, disaggregated our sample by where people were born. So we had the those who were born in Mexico and those who were born in the U.S. And it was a remarkable gradient that we got, that those of Mexican origin who were born in the U.S. Had basically identical rates to the U.S. population. And while the immigrants, those who were born in Mexico, had basically identical rates to those that from Mexico, Mexico City. And one of the things that we did was to desegregate even further the immigrants. So we had by length of stay here in the U.S., the median year, number of years, which was less than 13 or 13 or more. And what we had is that those who were here in the U.S., having been born in Mexico with less than 13 years, had the lowest rates, followed by the immigrants with 13 or more years, and followed by the U.S. born. And this is with the category of any disorders. If you break down that larger category by diagnostic categories, so we have the mood disorders, any mood disorders or any anxiety disorders or any substance abuse, the findings are very, very similar. But there is one that I want to bring to your attention, is that if you just select, and I didn't include that slide, if you break down further the any substance abuse disorders categories, so we have alcohol, drug abuse and dependence, or drugs abuse and dependence, there is a finding that is worth just mentioning to you, that when it comes to either alcohol dependence or drug, especially drug dependence, the U.S.-born people of Mexican origin in our study way surpassed any of the other comparison groups. So that's one of the flags that is worth keeping in mind. I also included a slide of another national survey. Our survey was done in Fresno County, so it's a local survey. But Maggie Alegría, our colleague, and David Takeuchi, both of them joined hands and they conducted this ENLAS national survey, which is the National Latino and Asian American Study. And I included just as a matter of comparison, a slide in which I put the lifetime disorders as well. And the instrument that Maggie and David Takeuchi use is basically the same as we use, you know, except that it is a more recent version. But what they documented is that there were significant differences if you look at the lifetime disorder between whites, which is about 43%, and Latinos, which it was about 30%. But if you disaggregate the Latinos by sub-ethnic groups, the picture you know, provides you with significant differences by lifetime prevalence rates. With Puerto Ricans having the highest rates, and then Mexicans, Mexicans and Cubans and other Latinos about the same kind of rates. But once again, the differences by Latinos and nativity was very significant, having the U.S. born with significantly higher rates than the immigrants. And I included also another slide focusing on major depressive episode and substance abuse. And the story there is that we cannot consider that one size fits all, that there are significant differences by the Latino subgroups, having, for example, that there are no differences when it comes to major depressive episodes between the U.S.-born and the immigrants, Puerto Ricans, for example, no significant differences, or the Cubans, or the other Latinos. The only differences were with the Mexican subgroup, having, once again, the U.S.-born with higher rates than the immigrants. However, when we consider substance abuse, there are no differences between the Puerto Ricans who were born in the island, Puerto Rico, or the mainland here, in terms of substance abuse. There were significant differences by the U.S.-born and the immigrant Cubans, Mexicans, and other Latinos. We continue to do analysis on other variables that have tended to be more explanatory about this complex issue about the importance of nativity in the prevalence rates. For example, we now know that the age of arrival to the U.S. makes a big difference. Actually, it is one of the most powerful predictors. And what we know is that those who arrive to the U.S. Before they turn, or by age 7, there are no differences in rates than the U.S.-born. And the older they come to the U.S., let's say by 18 or even older, that they tend to have lower rates across all the mental disorders. Also, the length of residence in the U.S. makes a difference, as I mentioned, you know, in the analysis that we did. And also, there are birth cohort differences. This is just for you to keep in mind that we continue to analyze data and try to look at the explanatory variables that can help us understand this phenomenon better. I also included a slide on that looks at the rates of service utilization for our MAP study. And it has who is being treated and treated comprehensively. You know, we had four categories of service utilization. One was with the general medical sector, another one with the specialty mental health sector, another one that we call other professionals that includes, nurses, social workers, religious leaders, from priests, ministers, rabbis. And then we had the informal sector that includes curanderos, sobadores, folk healers. And when we put together all of those four sectors, only one out of three of the U.S.-born in our sample received care. Any of those four, from any of those four sectors, one out of six of the immigrants received care, and only less than one in 10 of the migrant agricultural workers received care. And this is in folks that needed services because they met criteria for one or more mental disorders in the last 12 months. One of the issues that I want to bring to your attention is that there is a relative lack of engagement of Latinos in healthcare services. There is data that shows that Latinos are more likely than non-Hispanic whites to terminate treatment prematurely, with as many as 60 to 75% of Latinos dropping out after just one session. You know, it takes a while for Latinos to have access to care. And then once they get into care, you know, a good proportion of them don't return for a second visit. And we can discuss what might be related to that. Dr. Alegría's last study, she showed that only about 50% of the respondents in treatment say that they completed the treatment. And the mode number of visits was one for her sample, and the median was three to both psychiatrists and psychologists. So it isn't that much better for for what Dr. Alegria found. Just the, to wrap up and to finalize, you know, it is not only bad news that I want to discuss with you, you know, and bad news especially for the second generation or two generation Latinos. There are good news as well. And the good news is that despite the low income and many, many risk factors that Latinos face, especially the immigrants, they tend to be a very healthy population, you know, very resilient. This is has been described as the Latino paradox. And there are other names that I have seen. The other thing is that many Latino immigrants come to the U.S. with better health status than would be expected, given their socioeconomic status. We know that there are cultural norms that tend to be protective, and also we know that there are very durable transnational family and social networks, and that these are instrumental in meeting emotional needs very effectively for these populations. There are also healthy habits that seem to contribute to good health outcomes. You know, exercise and, you know, being very active, and also the at least the original diets that they had when they migrated to the U.S., something that unfortunately tends to disappear with years in the U.S. And the final point that I want to make is that there are specific cultural factors that serve as protective factors, and we need to reinforce those factors, you know, in terms of the lifestyle of some of the Latinos. I have a colleague who is the president of Radio Bilingue, here in California. That coined the term that la cultura cura, that culture cures, and that it is important to keep in mind what are some of those protective factors that can be reinforced and can be in these populations. So I'm going to stop here, Paul and colleagues, and I'll be happy to engage in conversation.
Thanks very much. That's very informative. And does anyone have questions at this point? I just was wondering specifically on that last slide, what are some of the specific cultural behaviors that you were referring to?
One of them is the importance of including family in you know, in almost anything. Is family intactness has proven to be a very strong protective factor. Just to give you a sense, at one point I was living in Fresno, California. And I was, I'm a clinician, and I was giving, you know, clinical services. When people came to my office, Latinos, especially most of the folks who came were of Mexican origin, they would come with always or almost always accompanied by one, and sometimes even with almost the whole family. And I was criticized by some of my colleagues who said, "Boy, you know, your patients come with so many people that they take over all the seats available in the lobby." And while they are looking at you know, the number of people that would come, I was looking at from the protective side. And more recently, I'm involved right now on a study of you know, the elderly access to care for elderly depressed folks. And we have two samples primarily. We have whites and Latinos. And it's something that has emerged clearly, as is that when those Latinos who come accompanied, they tend to adhere to treatment and to get better quicker than those who are by themselves. Mm-hmm. And it is very clear that the family, once again, is definitely a protective factor. But also can be, it is possible that it may not be, you know. The family dynamics, you know, there are some issues within family that can be, can work, you know, in other ways. And just to give you a sense, I don't know if you guys know, but if you consider suicidal behaviors in high school age kids for years, those who are at higher risk for suicidal thoughts, for suicidal plans and attempts are Latina adolescent girls. And it is related to incredible dynamics that happen between the first and second generation, or sometimes third generation. Those are the other piece, Paul and colleagues, is that as I observe in Fresno County, especially in the rural areas, that Latino immigrants tend to exercise quite a bit. You know, they are not as accustomed to use cars or transportation, so they walk a lot. And also, they tend to purchase food, at least when they just migrate. That tends to be, you know, unprocessed and without preservatives. Unfortunately, the longer they integrate and acculturate, they start buying, you know, food. For example, junk food, in which with little money, they can double the portions, and because it is, they don't have too much money, and they have to take advantage of whatever resources they have. Once they, let's say, supersize it, or they buy the bucket of sodas for just a dollar and a half, then they drink the whole thing or eat the whole thing. And unfortunately, that has translated into significant issues of obesity and diabetes for Latinos, which is, just to give you a sense, in the Central Valley, here in California, about 40% of the Latino kids are either overweight or obese, which is going to be a tremendous, tremendous problem. Mm. It is a tremendous problem. Mm.
The one thing we talked with Martha Stiles about, and some of the other people in California with the AgriBility Project, was that from their point of view, that the women tended to be the keepers of the kind of the health culture within the community. And I was wondering if, you know, when you talked about lack of engagement, do you see a difference, or have you looked at the difference between male and female in terms of engagement rate?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it is true. What we have found is that females tend to have a higher rate of engagement with the health services. Actually, males tend to be very reluctant to seek services, even when they know that they need them. And we saw that in our own study and in other studies as well. And, you know, one of the things that we did when we published our first data for the MAP study was that we received funding from the California Endowment here in California, which is the largest private foundation, a health-related foundation. We did funding for 4 years to increase the access to care of the low-income rural, primarily Latino folks in the Central Valley, and it was we went to especially the rural areas to try to enroll folks that needed mental health services. And we work out the details with the county mental health system to streamline, the referrals. So they would take these folks who needed services. And what I can tell you is that it was very difficult to get men. Women, by the most part, were the ones who worried a lot that their husbands or brothers or parents, fathers, wouldn't be amenable to get into treatment.
Mm-hmm.
To the point that as part of the interventions, we use theater, teatro campesino, to try to get to these issues, creating skits that would speak to those issues. So we would try to break some of those barriers.
Another thing that Martha and some of the other agribility projects have talked about is the use of promotores. And
yes.
I don't know how trained they are in mental health type of services, but is that a viable option for reaching some of these communities?
Absolutely. It is, actually. They are widely used not only here in California, but in across the nation. I think that's one of the models of workforce that allow for serve as liaisons with the health systems and navigators on what tends to be very complicated health systems that provide information and education not only about health-related issues, but to mental health-related issues. We work with promotoras, actually, and we are starting to see some studies that are providing evidence about the effectiveness on some of the interventions that they do at their own level. We just had a study done in Central Valley using, telecommunications of having promotoras, coaches to treat the depression. And what we're finding is that they were quite effective in providing information and education about diabetes control over the, Skype, and that brought under control, with better hemoglobin 1AC and blood sugar as well controls. So there is an emerging body of literature that indicates how effective promotoras can be, and this is of critical importance on the eve of healthcare reform implementation, given the incredible shortage of physicians and nurses, and as well as other professions.
Could you just describe a little bit about who the promotoras are and how people become promotoras? I'm not sure everybody understands that. I know. I don't quite understand all that process. And
but promotoras are or promotores, it can be men and women. Usually are women. These are people who are, known in the community by the most part, who, have limited education and who have developed trust and credibility in their communities. You know, they can be seen as cultural brokers and people on the know that are able to provide education and information about health related information, and also they serve as effective liaison with health systems, helping to from enrolling to a specific insurance coverage to helping folks navigate the health systems, which is very challenging. That's one of the reasons I think that the data that I just shared with you, that up to 75% of Latinos don't return for a second time. And it may be related to the kind of experience some Latinos have in navigating a health system.
Mm-hmm.
So Promotoras is a workforce, lay people with limited education, but that have a high degree of credibility and trust with the people that we want to target.
Great. Sergio, that kind of brings the discussion of cultural competency when it comes to either health or behavioral health interventions or treatment. When you're talking about the lack of engagement or them returning for treatment, do you think that has a role to play in it?
Oh, big time. We know that issues of culture and language play a big role in, on certain health-related outcomes. And I see it. These are things that I'm very familiar with because of the work that we do. I can tell you, for example, we work very closely here at UC Davis Health System with the Medical Interpreting Department. The faith and the credibility that the interpreters have with Spanish-speaking, monolingual Spanish-speaking, or Hmong, or, Russian, or Mien, or, several other languages is tremendous. Sometimes they have more trust and with interpreters than their own doctors, and I think that it is to a great extent that people connect through language and through their culture, and they feel much more at ease, and they can it's an invitation to try to share better and more accurately what is happening to them, and not to be as guarded. So it really, issues of culture and language play a huge role in access to care and also the quality of care that is delivered.
That raises a question to me. I hadn't thought of this before, but I don't know if you have any idea of percentages, but if a Spanish speaker is looking for mental health treatment, what are the odds? Are they going to be able to find somebody that's a therapist or a clinician that is a Spanish speaker, or will they have to, have a translator for, dealing with these types of sensitive mental health issues?
Yeah, well, that's a huge challenge, Paul. Because you are right. Most of the highest proportion of the workforce are not Spanish speaking, or Latinos for that matter. Just to give you a sense, here in California, about 40% of the population are of Latino origin, and only 5% of the physicians are Latinos, or only 5% of the psychologists or the nurses are Latino. So there is a tremendous disparity there. But it is just unrealistic to think that disparity will tend to disappear or even reduce significantly in the near future. So one of the issues is to have interpreters. But when it comes to mental health, that is extremely challenging. It's almost an impossible task to have, people trust, even though they speak the same language that they do, trust in a stranger with what they consider very personal issues related to depression, for example, or sexuality, or those kind of things, and so it is a very, very challenging. But I think that is definitely better than not to do it. And this also brings the issue of having family members are interpreters, that especially the kids who tend to be English speaking translate or to their mother or father, which here in California is not permitted. So it is it's very problematic because of issues of privacy and confidentiality, and putting the kids and the parents in untenable situations, untenable positions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, developing the relationship between the client and the therapist is tough enough, but throwing in another, a translator or family member would multiply the issues.
It does. Yeah. Can you imagine, that they are talking, a mother that is depressed, and she has her teenage daughter or teenage son, and the doctor is talking about sexuality issues,
mm-hmm.
or something that is even more personal. It is just putting in very awkward, situations that should be avoided.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are actually at the end of our hour. Does anybody have any final questions before we end for today? Well, Doctor, thanks so much for addressing this topic. It's not one that we hear about a lot, so I think it's important for us to keep, as Rick was talking about, trying to improve our cultural competency, and so we'll definitely want to make this available to the other agribility staff that are able to listen when they're able. So, again, thanks very much for your expertise and participation. And
my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation. And in the future, if issues of culture and language are of importance for you, I'll be happy to once again visit with you.
Great.
Okay.
Okay. No right. Final questions. We will say goodbye for today.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.